Hi, my name is Geraldo Cadava, and I want to thank you for tuning into Season 3 of Writing Latinos, a podcast from Public Books. We're back for more terrific conversations with Latino authors writing about the wide world of Latinidad. As always, we aim to provide thoughtful reflections on Latino history, culture, politics, and identity, and how writing conveys some of its meanings. Don't forget to like and subscribe to Writing Latinos wherever you get your podcasts. And now for the show. Nicolas Medina Mora is a Mexico City-based writer and journalist. His writing has appeared in N Plus One, The Nation, The Atlantic, The New York Times, and many other publications. His first novel, America del Norte, was published last year by Soho Press. It's a wide-ranging work of autofiction which follows the migration of his protagonist, Sebastián Arteaga y Salazar, from Mexico to New Haven, where he was a student at Yale, and Iowa City, where he was a student in the University of Iowa's MFA program in creative nonfiction. America del Norte is about many, many things: art, literature, the social and political elite in Mexico, and the long sweep of Mexican history and U.S.-Mexico relations, and not least, identities forged between the United States and Mexico. I'm so glad to talk to you today, Nicolas. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Gerald. It's a pleasure.
So one of the themes that most drew me in America del Norte is how Mexico's past and the history of U.S.-Mexico relations, and not to mention the history of Sebastián's family, continues to shape the present. So can you talk about how you see the relationship between the past and the present? I'm going to read a quote that opens your book that I think is really telling here. So let me do that. And the quote is from Alfonso Reyes, who wrote, "What happened continues to happen. It lives on, a luminous ghost fluttering in the vastness of the night. This is why a watcher of the skies who stood on a particular star and pointed his most powerful telescope toward our world would see at this very hour Hernán Cortés and his soldiers gazing over the valley of Anahuac." So to tell the story that you wanted to tell in America del Norte, why did you feel like you needed to go back 500 years into the past? And what is the legacy of that past for us today?
Well, so I think there's a number of different reasons, right? I think the most important one, I guess, is that Sebastián has a problem, right? The protagonist of the novel, which is that the life that he thinks or he thought he was going to have sort of falls apart, right? And in his attempt to understand why this happened and what he should do, given that his life project is not going to unfold in the way that he expected, he decides that like the way to understand this is just to go back, right? And to try to like see what are the deep causes of the contemporary dynamics that led to this this kind of like personal catastrophe, or maybe not catastrophe, but you know, this like series of problems. So there's that, right? And then there's the other side, which is I was interested in the ways in which Mexico and the United States are similar and also very different, right? And Sebastián, in a way, kind of like embodies the difficulties that arise when you actually think that the two countries or people from the two countries can understand one another, and they become convinced that they can, and then it turns out that they cannot. And I think that one of the main differences between Mexico and the United States is that in Mexico, history is very much alive, right? The past is very much present. You walk around downtown Mexico City in the Zócalo, which is the central plaza, the main square, and you look to the right of the cathedral, you will see this empty space. And if you walk closer, you'll notice that there's, you know, this sort of like ruined pyramid that is several feet below street level. And that's the ruins of the great temple of the Mexica, which is how the people that we refer to as the Aztecs call themselves. And if you look closely, you start to notice that the stones that were used to build the cathedral were taken from this pyramid. And if you walk around, you know, you will see these colonial palazzos, and all of a sudden there's like a head of Quetzalcoatl, the Mexica deity, jutting out from one of the foundations of one of these colonial palazzos, right? And so in the United States, you see the opposite, right? The United States, I like to say, is a country that is predicated on amnesia, partially because the foundation of the country was so violent and awful, and also because, you know, indigenous people in the United States, for any number of reasons that we can go into if you want, were, you know, the genocide was much more effective and complete, right? And so in Mexico, it's a different story because the genocide, for all, you know, despite all of the Spaniards' attempts to the country, didn't succeed to the same extent. And so in the States, if you ask, you know, like a random person, who were your great grandparents? They won't be able to tell you. You know, maybe they will be to tell you, you know, like, oh, well, you know, his name was Bill, her name was Mary. They were from Germany. And you ask them, okay, what part of Germany? And they're like, I don't know. And so I guess that that insisting on history, right, and having Sebas be somebody who's so obsessed with history and have him, like, try to write this book that is essentially history of Mexico for the United States, for an American audience, was a way of highlighting this radical difference. And so, yeah, I think, like, those are the two main reasons, you know, that in Mexico the past feels very present. In the United States, it also feels present, but in a much more ghostly and much more underground way. And also because, you know, the protagonist is somebody who is confused why the charmed life that he was promised isn't going to happen. And then he tries to go back to find, you know, the moment where it all went wrong. And it turns out that, you know, it's 500 years ago, right?
I thought it was really interesting that the backdrop of the story is Sebas' failed efforts to write a history of Mexico. And the exact nature of that failure is a bit ambiguous. Is it Mexico's failure? Is it Sebas' failure?
I think it's both, right? And it's also commentary on the foolishness of trying to understand the past, right? Of trying to write a history. Sebastian's failure is fundamentally that no matter how much history he reads and how much he rewrites, right, and how much he reorders it and how far back he goes, he's still, you know, he's left in the same place that he was before he started writing all of this. He has understood nothing. He has learned a great deal. But the mystery remains, right? And by the end of the book, I think that he essentially surrenders to the mystery. And you know, there's this moment at the very end when he's standing in the Zócalo, this plaza that I was just describing, on the day of the election of Andrés Manuel López Obrador, the former president of Mexico, who is, you know, a character in the book, a peripheral one, but an important one, I think. And, you know, people are singing and everybody's very happy. And, of course, Sebastián, who is a member of the Mexican elite, this is a defeat for his class, right? And a defeat for his family. But nonetheless, he just lets go, you know? And realizes that he actually cannot explain what is going on, what has happened to him, that the past is a foreign country and inaccessible, and that's okay. On the other side of it, you know, besides sort of like the inevitable failure of history writing, there's also the notion of Mexico as a failure, right? And the heading of the chapter where Sebastian writes to his teacher at Iowa to tell her that his thesis is a disaster and that he has failed, right? And that it just doesn't work, it doesn't cohere, it doesn't make any sense. The heading of that chapter is La Jaula de la Melancolía, which is the title of a book by a Mexican anthropologist and thinker called Roger Bartra. Bartra's thesis basically is that this notion that, you know, no matter how hard Mexico tries, it is always defeated, it always fails. You know, it's a critique of that idea, his book, right? He says that this is a, first of all, it's false. Second of all, it's a, you know, like a pathology, right? Like this need to define yourself as the loser, right? And I think that maybe it's like a little bit more ironized than I think is accessible to readers who are not familiar with that, right? Which is something I think happens throughout the book, that there's like a number of little keys that are meant to help readers interpret it, but that are fairly esoteric. And so Sebastian is convinced that Mexico is a failure and that Mexico will always fail, and that therefore it is somehow fitting that his history of Mexico is itself a failure. But that's because Sebastian is trapped in the cage of melancholy, right? Like La Jaula de la Melancolía. And then on the other side, though, there's the fact that, you know, that if Mexico and the United States are in some kind of competition, or if there's a question of who's winning and who's losing, or who has succeeded and who has failed, there is no question that Mexico has lost, right? And so I think that this unequal relationship, this partnership that isn't really a partnership, where the United States always wins and Mexico always loses, and where even the most elite of Mexicans winds up becoming a loser and winds up losing and failing, even when he tries to understand the causes for his failure. I think that's actually, that is actually, I think, a fairly accurate allegory of the relationship between the two countries. So it's the two things at once, right? Or I guess the three things. The inevitable failure of any attempt to write history, the Sebastian's very Mexican and, I think, ultimately pathological taking refuge in considering himself a failure. And then thirdly, the fact that, yes, it is a metaphor for the uneven and unequal relationship between the two countries.
Your prologue is called Mexico City 1847. And I think to the point we were talking about earlier about the history already being written, you write under the title of the prologue, in which the outcome of this tale is revealed from the start, which gave me the feeling that this is a kind of original moment of Mexican loss in relation to the United States. What I wanted to ask you about actually is a really interesting character that you introduce us to in that prologue, because, you know, there's a way in American history or Latino history that you can talk about that as a moment of imperialism and gross expansion where a much greater power dominates a lesser power. But you introduce us to this character who in that moment goes up to, I can't remember if it's Washington or Philadelphia, but to represent the interests of his class, mm-hmm. which is a different kind of angle on the US-Mexico war than I had seen before. And I think it also introduces us to one of the themes of your story, is how in the face of the power imbalances between these two nations, you have characters who were still kind of trying to go around that story to represent their individual interests. So I'm wondering if you could tell the audience a little bit about who this character is, what he's doing going to the United States, and how he kind of sets up a lot of what you want to talk about in the rest of the book.
Sure. So the character's name is Luciano Fernando Arteaga y Salazar, mm-hmm. Lucifer, right? and he is a distant ancestor of our protagonist, Sebastián Arteaga y Salazar. And, you know, he is the scion of a wealthy family who gets sent to England to study and then travels around Europe, meeting, you know, the great minds of the age, and then comes back to Mexico and becomes a translator. The novel doesn't actually say what kind of translating he does, but I think the implication, given what happens later in the book, is that he's a kind of literary translator, right? And then he gets chosen by this cabal of elite Mexicans to be sort of like their unofficial ambassador to the U.S. Because they realize that their interests as a class don't necessarily coincide with the interests of most Mexicans or of the nation as a whole, right? Which I think is true. And so this young Mexican educated abroad travels to the US to act as a mediator and to negotiate with the Americans and to convince them to at the very least spare the upper class. This is an allegory for NAFTA, partially, right? Because that's exactly what NAFTA was, right? I think it was a sincere attempt on the part of the Mexican elite. I mean, they certainly told themselves that it wasn't just for their class, but I think in practice that's what it was. To find a way to, you know, see eye to eye with the Americans and just, you know, prevent the worst catastrophe from happening by making increasingly intense concessions, right? And I think that, like, this, this character is meant to introduce this figure of the Creole, right? And I mean Creole here as a translation of criollo, and which is the term that in the colonial caste system was used to designate the children of Spaniards born in the American colonies of the Habsburg Empire and later of the Spanish Bourbon monarchy, right? And so, you know, these people are phenotypically European, right? But they are not given the same rights as Spaniards born in Spain. And so the traditional role is that of mediators, administrators, translators, right? And I guess what the prologue is trying to argue, right, is that the Creole as a mediator between the two countries is somebody who
exists in a subaltern position vis-a-vis the United States, but not vis-a-vis most other Mexicans. He is, you know, part of the elite. He is, you know, shielded from like the worst horrors of imperialism. And then, you know, whether because they sincerely think that there is a maybe a way out of like this endless conflict that begins with the Mexican-American War, or because they're cynical and they just want to like make sure that, you know, their mines in Guanajuato or whatever don't get, you know, taken over by like American corporations or by American interests, they go and they try to make friends with the Americans, and then they fail inevitably, right? So the Creole is sort of like this tragic figure and not a particularly sympathetic one. And Sebastian, our protagonist, is of course the contemporary incarnation of that. Mm-hmm. He gets sent to study abroad, right? You know, his parents make sure that he grows up speaking nearly flawless English. And then he goes to America and he becomes enamored of America and of Americans, I suppose. And then, you know, like when shit hits the fan, when like when this new crisis arises, basically because Trump gets elected the first time, he tries to negotiate. He tries to be the translator. And it doesn't work out, right? As it turns out, even though he can translate Baroque poems into English with the woman he loves, who's an American, he can't even understand her, and she can't even understand him.
Writing Latinos is brought to you by Public Books, an online magazine of ideas, arts, and scholarship. You can find us at publicbooks.org. That's PUBLICBOOKS.org. To donate to Public Books, visit publicbooks.org/donate. One thing I was going to ask about Sebastian, I mean, he learns a lot about, I mean, this is a podcast called Writing Latinos. Mm-hmm. It's about all of the ways in which writers have thought about the subject of Latinidad and what we can learn about Latino identity from the ways in which authors have written about it. And I, in really subtle ways, I think Sebastian learns a lot about Latinidad and his own stance in relation to it from a character named Mayeli, who is another student in the University of Iowa's MFA program. And so I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what Sebastian learns from Mayeli and who is Mayeli and what is her relationship with Sebastian like?
Sure. So Mayeli Revueltas is a Mexican-American writer who is Sebastian's classmate in the program, right? And when he shows up at Iowa, Sebastian, he's introduced to Mayeli and, you know, they're told by a classmate, you guys are both Mexican, you should talk. And they are the only two people who, I mean, Sebastian is white, but, you know, like, the Iowans don't know this, right? They're the only people who are seen by their classmates as not white in the entire program, which is true to life, for whatever it's worth. And so they're kind of like put in this position where they are asked to be something for one another that they very soon discover they cannot be. Mayeli is an American citizen, but her parents are undocumented immigrants from Guerrero, right? And very working class people, right? Like, and at first Mayeli, I think, extends to Sebastian this vote of confidence that is, you know, based on what we could call like the big tent of Latinidad, right? Saying like, well, you know, okay, like, you know, seems you're different, but not that different. And you should come over to my family's house, you know, in Mississippi for, you know, for Labor Day. Because they have become very close though. But at the same time, Sebastian from the start or very soon begins to develop this giant anxiety, which is that Mayeli is going to soon realize that he is actually nothing like her, that he has much more in common with their white classmates, even though he's Mexican. And I think fundamentally it's a question of class, but also of caste, and we can talk about that in a second, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Then they both go to Mayeli's family's house, and then there's a couple of incidents that highlight this difference between Mayeli and Sebastian and essentially destroy their friendship. And so what Sebastian learns there, you know, at Mayeli's family's house, you know, the family owns a restaurant, a Mexican restaurant, and at one point Sebastian is like washing dishes at the end of the day. And he realizes that this kind of like bittersweet joy that he felt for a moment as he was like ferrying bowls of menudo and birria to the tables, to, you know, where like all of this like very tired looking people are sitting because they have had to drive for a long time to get to this Mexican restaurant, which is the only Mexican restaurant in many miles. He feels this bittersweet joy at feeling that he has this bond that links them to all the strangers, right? But then, you know, immediately after that, he realizes that this is illusion, this is an illusion. He has nothing in common with them. And this is, you know, like a disillusionment for him and a disappointment. And I think that's the moment where he realizes that no matter how large and how big the tent of Latinidad is, he could only live within this tent if he were willing to commit a great dishonesty, right? If he were willing to lie and hide things about himself, as he has been doing to his friend Mayeli, who very soon realizes that, you know, this guy's actually very wealthy and comes from a very powerful family and, you know, he's white. And that's the end of their friendship, right? So, yes, I think, like, you know, Sebastian learns a number of things, right? He learns that in the eyes of white Americans, he's not white. In the eyes of at least some Latinos, he is definitely white. He feels increasingly, and I think at the end entirely, that he's not a person of color, he's not a Latino, and yet he's a subaltern. You know, not like a real subaltern in the sense of, you know, somebody who has been reduced to bare life, but for all of his wealth and for all of his cultural capital and for all of his talent, even if you want to, and for all of like his work at playing the meritocratic game, he won't even be able to stay in the country where he wants to live, right? And of course, his return to Mexico is nothing like, nowhere near as painful as the return to Mexico of most Mexicans who live in the United States, right? Who return either because they are deported or because they give up or because, you know, even if they succeed in everything and they come back to their town, to their pueblo, and realize that they have been changed and that they are no longer at home anywhere.
Yeah.
Sebastian lives like a very elite version of that. But even like that commonality, you know, like the horror of return or like the pain of return still isn't enough because Sebastian isn't a Latino, he's a criollo, right? He occupies this role of mediator for the elites of the two countries. And when the elite of one country decides that they have no use for him anymore, he's back to Mexico.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, for what it's worth, I think that distance that Sebastian feels from Mayeli, you know, when he recognizes that he's actually much more like wealthy Americans than he is like Mayeli, I think that's an experience that Latinos who are U.S. citizens can have with one another as well. You know, I mean, I think, you know, I think it's an interesting wrinkle to think about, you know, the transnational elite, mm-hmm. but it's, you know, Latinidad, I think it's such a kind of fractured community. And I don't necessarily mean broken, although I might mean that too, but I mean just diverse and multifaceted that
right.
I think between Latinos who are U.S. citizens, you can also recognize that kind of distance as well. Sebastian is also like Mayeli's parents because they're both, you know, they're co-nationals, they're Mexican citizens, which made me want to ask you about, you know, what the kind of status of the undocumented Mexican is within Mexico and how are they regarded by a Mexican elite? Are they recognized as kind of Mexican co-nationals who are similar to all other Mexicans?
Well, so, you know, I think like the Mexican elite regards undocumented Mexicans in the U.S. and Mexican Americans more broadly, you know, kind of like with this schizophrenic, you know, ambivalence, right? On the one hand, there's like a great deal of condescension and a great deal of, you know, sort of a pity, right? It's kind of like, oh, nuestros pobres paisanos, right? Like mm-hmm. our poor country mm-hmm. people, you know, mm-hmm. they really treat them awfully in the States. We should like show them solidarity. And then, you know, like if you talk to Mexican politicians until honestly quite recently, they would often say things sort of like the hope of this country, nay, of the Americas is in the dreamers, right? And by the dreamers, you know, they didn't just mean anybody who was eligible for DACA, right? Like they mean sort of like people who had also managed to beat the odds of the rigged meritocracy and become, you know, accomplished in this very narrow sense that to them read as those Mexicans are the best Mexicans, right? both of which are very condescending, right? As the other side of the coin, which, you know, I think the prime example is in Octavio Paz's The Labyrinth of Solitude, right? It's like seminal work of Mexican literature in the 20th century. There's this, you know, long essay where Paz, you know, doing armchair anthropology and sort of like, you know, out of his ass philosophizing, tries to like define Mexican identity in some sense, right? And the book opens with a long chapter on what he calls pachucos, which is, you know, a despective, derisive, derogatory term for Mexican Americans, and perhaps for what, you know, in some contexts and for some people, we might know as Chicanos or Chicanx people, right? And Paz says, you know, that the pachucos have no identity. They are neither Mexican nor American. They have no culture, and they're, you know, no wonder that they're so violent and that they're drunkards and that they wear those horrible suits, right? And I think that, like, that sort of spite, right? Like that hatred even is also present and often coexists with the condescension that I was just describing. So, you know, like Mayeli, right? Like, insofar as like she's a student at like this very elite MFA program, would likely, you know, if she were to come to Mexico and shake hands with, like, you know, the Secretary of Foreign Relations or whatever, he would be like, "You're doing good. You're going good, my mija. You know, like, you're making us all proud." And then, you know, she would go back and her parents would still be undocumented and everything was shitty, right? That's, I think, more or less the attitude, and one, yeah, that I, you know, that I really don't like. I think that that we, you know, like, that Mexicans in Mexico should think of Mexicans in the United States, whether or not they are Mexican nationals, you know, as, you know, at the same time, this part of the nation, if you will, and also as they're doing their own thing, and, you know, that they shouldn't be, we should never fault them for not being Mexican in the sense that, like, people here are Mexicans, right?
Yeah.
Like, they get to have their own thing, and it's just as valuable, right?
I'm a Latino historian, Latinos in the United States primarily, and I think there's emerging a really interesting conversation about Latinos and race here in a way that there hadn't been even 20 years ago when I was a graduate student. You know, when I was a graduate student, none of my reading lists included books about Afro-Latinos or indigenous Latinos. It was just like Chicanos and other Latino Americans, and it was a kind of undifferentiated race. But I don't know exactly what prompted it. I mean, part of it might be the murder of George Floyd, which created tensions between Latinos and African Americans that caused Afro-Latinos to say, "Well, we're Latino too." It might also be the 2030 census, which for the first time is going to make Hispanic and Latino a race, which has caused Afro-Latinos to say, "Latino is not a race. Latinos can be of any race, Black, Indigenous, Asian, etc." But that has led to this discourse of, like, white Latinos, Black Latinos. And it seems like there's this parallel discourse in Mexico about Whitexicans. And I was even thinking about, like, Namor's character. I can't remember the name of the actor who played Namor in the Black Panther movie, but he was kind of very upfront about indigeneity. Or I'm thinking about movies like Roma and the portrayals of indigeneity. So I don't know. I mean, that's a kind of, like, observation, I guess. But the question is, first of all, can you help me draw any kind of connections between the discourse of, like, white Latino in the United States and Whitexican in Mexico? And is Whitexican really a conversation within Mexico?
Yeah, I mean, like, so let me put it this way, right? Like, I think whiteness operates under different logics in different contexts, right? In the US, I think that the easiest way to understand whiteness is that it emerges from a political economy based on Chattel slavery and the one drop rule, right? And so, like, any one, you know, like, not that, like, this actually works, not that it actually works this way, right? Like, blood quantums are fictional, right? Like, I am a big fan of the Field Sisters book, Racecraft, right? Which, you know, like, where they argue that that, you know, we shouldn't talk about race. Race doesn't exist. But what certainly exists is racism, right? But in any case, in the US, the logic of whiteness is any single, smidge of non-European ancestry makes you either not white at all or less white. And in Mexico, it's the opposite. Every single smidge of additional European ancestry makes you whiter, right? And so in the US, you have like a binary system almost. And in Mexico, you have like this like gradient where you can actually kind of like become whiter, right? Obviously through generations, there's this awful phrase that I think Sebastian quotes at one point in the novel, vas a mejorar la raza. You're going to improve the stock, right? Which is something that like, you know, like your racist aunt will say to you if you happen to be dating a blonde, right? But you know, the issue here, of course, is that these two logics are in tension, right? And so criollos, right, creoles like Sebastian, present a problem for the American racial imaginary. Because on the one hand, they are quite obviously white, right? Not only in terms of their skin color, but also in terms of like their cultural capital, class position, all kinds of things, right? And on the other hand, they cannot be white in America. And I think the term whites again is actually very telling in that sense. Because the very fact that you have to modify it, right? That it's not just like that they're white seeking, right? It means that they're not exactly white, right? At least, you know, in English, in the sense of the term white. I think blanco is, you know, yeah, sure. You can be blanco in Mexico and yet not white. I will say also, you know, that this is why I insist on using colonial caste vocabularies to speak about like Mexican racial imaginaries, right? Or caste imaginaries. Because I think they make more space for class, because I think they make more space for gradients, for like different relationships to like indigenousness or indigeneity, right? But you know, of course, like Sebastian shows up at Iowa and he tries to tell them that he's a criollo, and this doesn't make any sense to anybody, not even to Mayeli, right? So yeah, I don't know, like is whitexican a thing in Mexico? Yes, absolutely, you know, but it's mostly a meme. You know, there is definitely an increasingly Americanized discourse about racial identity in Mexico that I think is, on the one hand, like very, you know, long overdue, because this country is just as racist as the US. It's just racist in a different way. And then on the other hand, very annoying, because it is actually just very different. And American racial vocabularies don't really work to describe Mexican political reality. And I think Sebastián is supposed to be sort of like, you know, at the level of ideas, the character is supposed to dramatize this by showing how these categories don't actually work, you know, to describe both places at once. And that whenever you have somebody who is occupying both places at once, they fit nowhere. I think that Latinidad as a political identity, as in, you know, like something that people call themselves to, you know, build solidarity, to, you know, find community, or just because they want to, is a great thing. I think as a description of reality, it runs into problems, right? So for instance, there's like this statistic that people throw around, which is that 55% of all Latino men voted for Trump, which is horrifying. But then you start to wonder, maybe the problem is in the category, right? That is not actually like a description of material reality. What it is an imaginary community, an imagined community that actually can have like a lot of potential for political action, but we shouldn't take the categories of the U.S. Census Bureau as nature rather than history.
I wanted to ask quickly, you know, this novel of yours has been identified as autofiction, and I'm wondering if that is a term that you also apply to your novel and how you feel about it and why you chose that genre as the best genre for what you wanted to do.
I absolutely think that America del Norte is a work of autofiction. What I mean by that, though, is something maybe that is not identical to what people have in mind. And I recently published actually an academic paper about this in the journal Studies in the Novel.
Oh, cool.
Because I think that like autofiction, as I understand it, you know, doesn't actually come from like France and from like Dubronsky and like Ernaux and like, you know, like that wave of like French autobiographical fiction or autobiographical writing. I think it actually comes, and I'm talking not just about like Latin American autofiction or like Hispanophone autofiction, I'm also talking about like contemporary American autofiction. It comes from Bolaño. And I think that like Bolaño's notion of autobiography, which is deeply ironic and deeply bookish, right? It's not so much about living as it is about reading and writing. It comes from Borges. And Borges, you know, we forget that many of his stories and poems and essays are narrated by what we could like identify as an artificial narrator, a guy called Jorge Luis Borges that shares many of the author's biographical details, his blindness, etc. But of course, in Borges, it's not a question of confessing, but rather of hiding, right? Autofiction, not as autobiographical fiction, but fiction about fiction that meditates on the fictional nature of the self and on the constructed nature of the self. And I think that at the moment that you have a text that is fictional, that is, you know, that doesn't actually claim to represent reality, and you can't tell whether the protagonist is the author or not, you know, whether I made Sebastian more or less pleasant than I actually am, how much of this actually happened, you are actually thrown into this like hall of mirrors that is very Borgesian, right? Like you no longer know what's real and what's not. And then the only conclusion you can come to is that there is no world, there's only the book. There isn't a self outside of literature. You create the self in the process of writing out of fiction.
Nicolas, thank you so much for joining us. Everyone go pick up your copy of America del Norte. It's a really rich book and really provocative, and it's beautifully written. So thank you, Nicolas, for joining us.
No, thank you so much, Rado. It was my pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Season 3 of Writing Latinos. We'd love to hear your suggestions for new books that we should be reading and talking about. Drop us a line at geraldo@publicbooks.org. That's GERALDO at publicbooks.org. This episode is brought to you by Public Books. It was produced by Tasha Sandoval. Our music is City of Mirrors by the Chicago-based band Dos Santos. You can follow us on Blue Sky, Instagram, and X to receive updates about Season 3 of Writing Latinos. I'm Geraldo Cadava. We'll see you again soon. Mm-hmm.